Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University. This is episode CXXII, Purple by Merit. With the murder of Caracalla, one of the most unlikely men step into power, and something tells me I'm going to get tired of saying that soon. Macrinus is unassuming, of the wrong position and the wrong class. He'd perhaps argue that he's the best man for the job, but very few in Rome would agree with him. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
All right, so where we left this off last time was with the murder of Caracalla. Murder the right word? Probably murder.
I think murder, you know, that he was assassinated. A couple of the guards. And this was because Macrinus found out through the letters that his neck was going to be on the chopping block. So he decided to enlist some soldiers in a conspiracy to get rid of Caracalla before he did away with him.
But there was no contingency plan after that. The plan was kill Caracalla and then everyone's gone, right, now what are we going to do?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was just an act of self-preservation on the part of Macrinus. Macrinus didn't seize power straight away. There's a couple of days pass by when the soldiers debate what to do. They end up with two possible candidates to succeed Caracalla, one of whom is Macrinus himself, and the other is his colleague as Praetorian Prefect, a man called Oclutinius Adventus. Caracalla has been in the East with his two prefects. You might remember he had some key allies back in Rome who were acting in place of the prefects there, but he actually brought both Adventus and Macrinus with him to the East. And it's a real difficult situation because they're still at war with Persia, and the Persian king Artabanus is approaching. Now, depending on who you read, there are different stories about this, because people might remember back to the Caracalla episode that Herodian has this entire story.
He's got the Red Wedding.
The Red Wedding, where there's a massacre at the wedding feast. And in Herodian, you know, the Persian king Artabanus wants to wreak his revenge. But that story doesn't exist in Dio.
So regardless, though, the Parthians are now coming?
The Parthians are on their way. Yeah. Rome needs an emperor right there on the spot. And this is a position which the Roman state increasingly finds itself in over the course of the 3rd century AD, is that the soldiers have murdered the emperor and the next emperor needs to come from people who are on the spot. So there's no reference back to the Senate at Rome. There needs to be a commander. And so they turn to the two most senior officials on the ground, Oclutinius Adventus and Macrinus, the Praetorian Prefects. Adventus declines because of his advanced old age. Cassius Dio also tells us he has problems with his eyesight as well. So Macrinus is the only other viable candidate to take the throne. And this is a really important moment in the history of the Roman Empire, because Macrinus is the first emperor to come directly from the equestrian order. Previously, all emperors had been senators.
Okay.
Even if their family was originally equestrian, the emperors themselves had been advanced into the senatorial order. So we've got this massive change from Augustus and the Julio-Claudians, when all the emperors come from one family, essentially. Then with AD 69, the year of the four emperors, the emperor can be selected from amongst senators who are in command of an army and have support of the Senate and people. Now in the 3rd century, because of the growing importance of the role of the Praetorian Prefect, who is the most senior equestrian official, he commands Praetorian Guard, but he also has an important legal role. We now have an emperor from the equestrian order, which then once again sets the precedent for other emperors throughout the 3rd century to be chosen from the equestrian order or even from lower down. And this is something we know made an impact at the time because of what Cassius Dio and Herodian say about it. Cassius Dio thinks that Macrinus should not have accepted the purple because he was an equestrian and he should have stood aside for a senator.
Interesting, yeah. But then he would say that.
Of course, because he is a senator from a senatorial family. And it's interesting that Dio actually has quite a positive write-up in many ways of Macrinus about his long legal career, but he doesn't like the fact that he doesn't stand aside for a senator. Mm. And this colours Dio's account of Macrinus's reign all the way through.
So Macrinus is proclaimed emperor on 11th of April, 217. Mm. And the birthday of Septimius Severus.
Yes.
Oh, that's an interesting pub trivia fact there for you.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think Macrinus may have been waiting for that.
Of course.
Waits for a couple of days and he is acclaimed on Severus's birthday. And I think that's really important because he needs to portray himself as a continuator of the Severan dynasty. He doesn't want to give the army the idea that there's been an upheaval or that there's not a firm hand at the tiller.
But he's completely misleading them.
Well, he even takes the name Severus as well. Marcus Aurelius Severus Macrinus is his full titulature. And you can see why he did that, because throughout most of the empire, people see the emperor on the coins with their titles, in inscriptions, in public pronouncements. And if they've never met Macrinus and don't know the details of the imperial family, if they continue to see the name Severus there, they think it's the same dynasty. He has a young son who is interestingly with him on the campaign, Marcus Aurelius Diadumenianus, who is only 9 years old. And he is made Caesar, so he's made a junior emperor. Macrinus is Augustus, Diadumenianus is Caesar. But he gives Diadumenianus the name Antoninus. So Marcus Aurelius Antoninus Diadumenianus.
Mm.
And this is continuing the tradition whereby Severus renamed his own son Septimius Bassianus as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. We better know him as Caracalla, but that he was named after the Antonine dynasty.
Since he hasn't come from the Senate, and it's such a departure for somebody in his role to become the emperor, the important thing to do is to get them on side.
Yes, though he doesn't start off very well on that account, because he writes to the Senate already giving himself the imperial titles. So he says, I have seized power, and Cassius Dio says that he gives himself the titles of Pius, Pius, Dutiful, Felix, Fortunate, and Augustus, without waiting for senatorial approval.
That could be showing a strong hand, but
it shows a strong hand with the army, because he's saying, I'm emperor, I've taken on this position. The Senate could declare another candidate if they wanted to, but they don't. And he really lays on the fact that he has the support of the army. And Cassius Dio quotes from his letter, Dio 79, 16.2. Macrinus says, I understand full well that you too had agreed with the legions, since I had the consciousness of having conferred many benefits upon the state. The best thing for you to do is to agree with the legions.
Mm-hmm.
He has the army at his back. And this is the army in Syria, of course, but we must remember that this is a massive field army which Caracalla had assembled for his Parthian campaigns. It has the Legio II Parthica, that legion which is stationed at Alba near Rome and now travels with the emperor. But it also crucially has vexillations, detachments drawn from legions all over the empire as well. And he's close to Egypt as well. If he's going to cut off the grain supply to Rome, that's one way to do it. He's in a similar position to Vespasian in that way as well.
Yeah, yeah. So the Senate really has no option, but they don't have to be happy about it.
No, I mean, they don't feel there's any viable alternative. And so they go along with it. Yes, yes.
Mm.
It's interesting to see Macrinus's attitude towards Caracalla. He doesn't condemn him officially, so he doesn't order the Senate to pass an act authorizing damnatum memoriae, the damnation of memory, but neither does he instruct them to deify Caracalla, to make him a god.
Mm.
Now, Caracalla is later deified, but that happens under the later Severans. So he doesn't want to alienate the Senate or the army. His power really depends on the army in Syria, amongst whom Caracalla had been very popular. So if there is going to be a damnatio, he wants the Senate themselves to authorize it rather than him instructing the Senate to do so.
Yeah. Okay, makes sense. At the same time, and as always in this sort of situation, and maybe in hindsight, there are convenient omens as to how the reign of Macrinus is going to go.
Yes, so he doesn't reign very long. He is only emperor from 217 to 218. And Dio says there were omens that foretold this. Dio says, and this is 79.25, "For a mule gave birth to a mule in Rome, and a sow to a little pig with four ears, two tongues, and 8 feet. A great earthquake occurred, blood flowed from a pipe, and bees formed honeycomb in the Forum Boarium," which is the cattle market, key marketplace in Rome.
Bees formed honeycomb in a market? I mean, okay.
It must have been a very big honeycomb to count as an omen, because that's what bees do.
Yeah.
So I sort of wonder if it was of a massive proportion, you know, perhaps covered the arch which sits in the Forum Boarium.
Blood flowed from a pipe. Well, that's rust.
Yep.
We
could say that.
A mule gives birth to a mule in Rome. And a sow to a little pig with four, okay, four ears, two tongues
and 8 feet.
Well, like, okay, sure. That's going to happen every now and then. But mules don't generally give birth at all, if I know my animal husbandry correct.
They're a cross between
A horse and a donkey.
A horse and a donkey.
And a sterile.
Yes, so the fact that a mule is able to give birth to another mule is a prodigy there.
Therefore, that indicates Macrinus isn't going to last long.
Yes, because it's indicating a deformed state.
So we have
deformed animals. Everything's not right with the state, you know, earthquakes, blood flowing. These are indications that there's problems within the res publica.
Mm.
And so Macrinus, the head of the empire, won't last long.
Let's go to the imminent approach of the Parthians.
Mm.
Now, Macrinus, his first instinct, I suppose, isn't for war. Caracalla was the one who was really pushing for war. Mm. And yes, at this point, so early in a reign with a kind of fragile leadership structure, he wouldn't want to welcome that sort of thing.
Yeah, he needs to consolidate his position. He needs to get the Senate on side, and he's probably making plans to get back to Rome within a couple of months as well. So he would want to conclude peace with the Parthians as quickly as possible, especially if it can be spun as some kind of victory as well. Dio tells us that Macrinus sent messages to Artabanus urging him to accept peace and laying the blame for the past upon Taraltas, which is his negative nickname for Caracalla after Gladiator. Dio goes on to say, and this is 79.26.2, "but Artabanus would not entertain this proposal and furthermore bade him rebuild the forts and the demolished cities, abandon Mesopotamia entirely, and make reparation for the injury done to the royal tombs as well as for the other damage."
So he wants a complete withdrawal, pretty much.
A complete withdrawal, and he wants payment as well,
yep.
So reparations.
Mm.
So there is going to be a battle, and Herodian writes these wonderful speeches, which he gives to his emperors. Herodian has Macrinus say in Book 4, 14 to the soldiers, "Look, you know, we know you supported Caracalla, but we now have this situation." So he says, "Therefore, let us take up our arms and our battle stations in the customary Roman good order. In the fighting, the undisciplined mob of barbarians, assembled only for temporary duty, may prove its own worst enemy."
That's good.
Yeah, so it's, you know, always the barbarians are the worst fighters, and Rome stands for order and discipline.
Yes, very cinematic.
Yes. Now, Dio and Herodian both provide accounts of the battle, which happens near Nisibis. Now, Dio's account is fragmentary in this section of the manuscript. So there are lots of lacunae, which is the Latin word for gaps in the manuscript. Mm. Herodian has more details and gives quite a different impression of the battle. So might talk about Herodian first then, because he has a great description, but then we'll set it against Dio's account then.
Can you draw a narrative at all out of Dio?
You can. In Dio, it's sort of more accidental. The battle begins with a fight over the water supply between the two armies. He doesn't go on for too long, whereas in Herodian, the battle goes for over 2 days.
Okay.
And he talks in great details about the Roman battle array, the legions in the front, the cavalry and the Moorish javelin wielders on the wings, and then light-armed and mobile troops in between. And he makes great play about the Parthian camel riders, who are clad in mail and are very good on the backs of the camels. However, the Romans brought down the camels, and this changed the course of the battle, because Herodian says that once the riders are thrown off the camels, they're not adept at close fighting hand to hand. So Herodian says, Book 4, 15.2, "The barbarians inflicted many wounds upon the Romans from above, and did considerable damage by the showers of arrows and the long spears of the mail-clad dromedary riders. But when the fighting came to close quarters, the Romans easily defeated the barbarians, for when the swarms of Parthian cavalry and hordes of dromedary riders were mauling them, the Romans pretended to retreat, and then they threw down caltrops and other keen-pointed iron devices. Covered by the sand, these were invisible to the horsemen and the dromedary riders and were fatal to the animals."
Mm. So it's like a barbed metal thing that the dromedary is going to run over.
And then they're going to fall over.
Dromedary being?
Camels.
One humped camel.
Yeah. You're the expert on the on the animals.
Yeah, so. Sorry. I'm just bringing home the animal husbandry facts.
No, it's good. It's really important. So Herodian has this going on for 2 days, and Macrinus thinks the Parthians are so keen at keeping up the battle because Artabanus, the king of the Parthians, thinks he's actually fighting Caracalla.
And why would he think otherwise?
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. He doesn't know about the unfortunate roadside comfort stop. So Macrinus sends a messenger to tell them that Caracalla is dead, and they arrange a peace treaty with Macrinus paying a subsidy of money to seal the deal with the Parthians.
So it doesn't sound like the Romans were really losing that war, but it's just one that he didn't want to fight.
Yes, he wants to consolidate his position back in Rome.
Yeah.
He wants to end the war, probably claim a victory, and then get back to Rome as emperor.
So how does Dio differ in his account of that?
So Dio says that Macrinus had already told the Parthians that Caracalla was dead.
Yeah.
And the Parthians attacked anyway.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes, because there's still a Roman army there.
Yeah.
Dio says it starts because of a conflict between the soldiers of the two armies over water.
Mm.
So we are in the eastern provinces, so our water is a precious commodity. But the battle is wrapped up very quickly, according to Dio, because Macrinus wants to reach peace terms. And he gives two reasons for this, and this is Dio 79:27.1. "Macrinus, both because of his natural cowardice, for being a Moor, he was exceedingly timorous."
Racist much?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Dio constantly links people's characteristics to their origin.
Yeah.
We see this also in his depiction of the Syrian branch of the Severan family as So, yes, in his eyes, Moors were cowardly. "And because," this is Dio continuing, "of the soldiers' lack of discipline, did not dare to fight the war out, but instead expended enormous sums in the form of gifts as well as money, which he presented both to Artabanus himself and to the powerful men around him, the entire outlay amounting to 200 million sesterces.
Yeah, wow.
So Dio not only plays on the trope that Macrinus is cowardly, he plays on the trope that in the East the legions lack discipline. They're given over to the pleasures of the East. And it's for these two reasons that he says that Macrinus makes peace. And 200 million sesterces, that's a enormous outlay from the imperial budget. It's difficult to put it in modern terms, but perhaps a billion or something like that. If we're thinking of a huge amount of money, that's an enormous part of the GDP of the Roman state.
Yeah.
This is actually the end, really, of Rome's conflicts with Parthia, because in the reign of Severus Alexander, they get conquered themselves by the Persians.
Right, so then it becomes an entirely different war.
Yes, it becomes a war against...
Technically.
Well, yes, it's a war against the Persians, and that really continues all the way up till the rise of the Arabs and Islam.
So Macrinus ends the Parthian War.
He ends the Parthian War, yes.
It's been going for generations at that point, really.
It has, yes. He doesn't solve peace in the Middle East, though. we can't sort of paint him in those terms.
So Parthicus?
Yes. So he doesn't actually tell the Senate in Rome that he reached this humiliating deal. He is awarded the title of Parthicus by the Senate, but he turns it down. Dio tells us because he felt shame about the way in which he'd achieved it.
Mm.
But Victoria Parthica, that sort of legend, the Parthian victory, does appear on coinage, for example. So
of Macrinus's.
Macrinus's reign, yeah. Yes. So it's clear that, you know, the coin types were all ready to mint, you know. Because you have to portray it as a victory, and especially if he's going to return to Rome. And he really tries to tie up the whole problem in the eastern provinces. He makes peace with Armenia, he sends the crown to Tiridates, and releases the king's mother, who had been held hostage by Caracalla.
Okay.
So Armenia is that important client kingdom, the buffer between Rome and Parthia. So he's really trying to consolidate his position there. Herodian has him writing to the Senate after the peace treaty.
Okay.
But it's a way of introducing himself to the Senate. So the chronology is different than in Dio.
Okay.
So in Dio, he's already written to the Senate before the battle.
Yes.
In Herodian, he writes the Senate after the battle, in which he justifies why he makes the peace treaty and why he has accepted power as an equestrian emperor.
Essentially trying to justify the fact that he's an emperor at all.
Yes, exactly.
So what are the reasons that he puts forward?
It's a wonderful letter, much like the speeches. So he says, and this is Herodian Book 5.1, it's the beginning of Book 5, "In signing a treaty of peace, we made a loyal friend instead of a dangerous enemy of a great king who had marched against us at the head of a formidable army. Under my rule, all men shall live in peace, and senatorial rule shall replace the autocracy." Now, this is really important because this is how Herodian thinks in terms of governments.
Mm-hmm.
So autocracy is the emperor who rules without the consent of the Senate, and then he has the oligarchy in which the Senate rules with the emperor.
And many emperors before have said, even symbolically, that they're handing back power to the Senate.
This is exactly what we see. You know, Septimius Severus takes power and says, "I'm going to work with you altogether.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to put any senator to death." But then he goes and does so.
Mm. And then government shut down.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think even Hadrian and Trajan both said the same sort of things. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And then Hadrian goes and executes four consulars. So,
Look, four's nothing compared to what we get with Septimius Severus.
Yes, and hundreds, and definitely. The other thing that Herodian has is this speech where he justifies why he has taken power. So he says in the letter to the Senate, "But let no one think me unworthy of my post, and let no one believe that fortune blundered in raising me to this position, even though I am of the equestrian order."
Mm.
And then he goes on to say, what good were the noble rulers? What good were people who inherited power through their fathers? He says, "What, may I ask, did the noble birth of Commodus profit you, or the fact that Caracalla inherited the throne from his father? Indeed, having received the empire as legal heirs, the two youths abused their high office and conducted themselves insolently, as if the empire were their own personal possession by right of inheritance." So this is really important, and this is a theme which we see both in Dio and Herodian. It's this tension between the fact that Rome has essentially become a hereditary monarchy. If there is a son, he will succeed.
Mm.
But there's also this other tension, this ideology of the best man. And this is what we see particularly coming to the fore with Nerva's selection of Trajan, for example. And so emperors are able to play the best man card.
Yeah.
I am the best emperor, often because of their generalship, you know, their command of the army.
It's a convincing argument.
It is, yes. And, you know, it's quite interesting that Dio has very detailed account of senatorial politics during Macrinus's reign. He's in Rome, and then Macrinus appoints him curator of Smyrna and Pergamon in Asia Minor. And Dio pays very close attention to Macrinus's appointments. He complains about him appointing equestrians directly to the rank of ex-consuls, so, you know, the chief magistracy within the Roman state, and then making them governors.
Mm.
And he's particularly irritated by the fact that these appointees originally came from the army, and they gained equestrian status through their service in the army. So Dio, early on in the account of the reign of Augustus, has this description of the people he thinks are suitable to become senators. Centurions, who can be of equestrian rank, they're fine to become senators. Everyone beneath that, no go. You know, he doesn't want them into the Senate. So Macrinus appoints two of his loyal stooges, Marcius Agrippa and Decius Tricianus, as ex-consuls, and then appoints them governors of Dacia and Pannonia. I think that if you look at the prosopographical evidence, now this is the evidence of senatorial appointments during this period, that Macrinus is actually quite clever, that he removes Caracalla's governors from the eastern provinces and the critically important Danube frontier, including Dacia and Pannonia, and appoints his own men, people like Marcius Agrippa and Tricianus. He's actually being quite clever, and it's rare for Roman emperors to do this, to actually replace wholesale a whole set of governors. So I think this is a strategic move.
And is Dio griping just Dio griping, or is he actually speaking for the Senate, do you think?
This is difficult. Yeah. I think that the Senate is composed of different factions. There's 600 men in the Senate.
Of course there'd be factions, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. They're not all going to think the same way. I think Dio represents a conservative block of senators who are resistant to any form of change and social mobility, particularly from men who rise up from the ranks of the army. But there are many senators who would be new men, the first in their family to reach the Senate. And for them, this is the natural course of things. There are people that Septimius Severus promoted into Senate who are new men, who Caracalla promoted into the Senate who are new men, because they're going to want to reward their supporters. So I think Dio comes from this conservative faction who doesn't want to see men promoted from the army into senatorial rank. He also criticizes Macrinus for promoting his colleague as Praetorian prefect, Oclotinius Adventus, into the Senate as well. So this is the man who said that he couldn't become emperor because he was too old, his eyesight was failing. And so Macrinus sends him to Rome to be urban prefect, which is the top position in the senatorial cursus.
Yeah.
It usually goes to people who have held the consulship for the second time. So this is Adventus, another man who has begun his career in the army, in the spy corps, then is advanced to equestrian rank, which is perfectly normal. He's able to do that. But Dio complains that he is then made consul for the second time without previously being in the Senate, and then made urban prefect, the most senior senatorial position. And Dio is incredibly negative about Oclotinius Adventus. He says in 79.14.1, he could neither see by reason of old age, nor read for lack of education, nor accomplish anything for want of experience. So Dio is saying that Macrinus has appointed this doddering old fool who is uneducated, can't see, and is just an embarrassment. And Dio says that Macrinus did this to make himself look better.
Mm.
If he sends someone to Rome who is a complete fool, then the emperor himself isn't going to seem so bad in comparison.
Yeah, yeah. It's just putting a trusted ally in a position, though, yeah, really. Yeah,
exactly. I don't think Macrinus was trying to behave foolishly.
Mm.
I think he was saying, I'm going to send Adventus back to Rome to be a key ally, just as you say, and to keep watch over Rome for me.
Mm.
However, due to senatorial protests, Macrinus had to replace Adventus with another senior senator, Marius Maximus, who is actually the Marius Maximus who wrote the series of imperial biographies which the Historia Augusta used.
Oh, right.
Marius Maximus had been a general of Septimius Severus, is now a very senior senator, but he obviously enjoyed writing scholarly biographies about the emperors as well. So, again, you know, we shouldn't see the senators as a block. People can serve emperors, but still write nasty things about them behind their back. And I think what happens after the death of Caracalla and the ascent of Macrinus is that the Senate really turns on itself. With Dio's account here, we get a level of detail that we perhaps haven't seen since Tacitus's annals and what's happening under Tiberius and Claudius. Here we get some senators who want to call Caracalla's senatorial supporters to account. And these are particularly what we call the delatores, the informers. So people who would inform on their fellow senators and equestrians in order to curry favour with the emperor.
Mm.
Macrinus initially refuses to release their names because he doesn't want to lead to all-out conflict, but then he does release the names of three particularly odious informers whom he wanted to be rid of. So they're sort of scapegoats. Yeah,
yep.
And they're exiled to islands. One of these is Lucilius Panzer Priscillianus, one of Caracalla's associates, who was exiled to an island because of his informing. And he was one of these new men who really benefited from Caracalla's regime or supported by Caracalla. And he was also something of a larger-than-life figure. So Cassius Dio says in 79:21-3-4, Priscillianus was a man notorious alike for his insolent behaviour and for his killing of wild beasts. For he often fought with them, always in large numbers, at Tusculum, so that he bore the scars of their bites. And once unassisted, he joined battle with a bear, a panther, a lioness, and a lion all at the same time.
What?
It's quite incredible.
Who does that?
Well,
Commodus.
Yeah. Commodus, Priscillianus. But these are the sort of men who Caracalla and Commodus attracted.
Mm.
And Dio wasn't one of them. He wasn't part of their club. So he and other conservative senators wanted to see them removed. Now, it's interesting that many other senators wanted to serve Macrinus. For example, Marius Maximus happily accepts the role of urban prefect, for example. So we can't say that the emperor was completely alienated from the Senate. But we also hear the people at Rome becoming hostile to Macrinus. And they become hostile after hearing of the death of a senator, Aurelianus, on Macrinus's campaign, who Macrinus had to offer up to the soldiers. And also when they hear that Macrinus's son, Digimenianus, had taken the name of Antoninus. And at the horse races to celebrate Digimenianus's birthday in Rome, the people called out in unison and protested at this and called upon Jupiter to save them and that the god, the king of the gods, alone should lead them. So we begin to see popular discontent with Macrinus as emperor.
So is this why Macrinus isn't hurrying back to Rome immediately?
Yes. He needs to consolidate his position in the east, which is why he replaces the governors in an arc, really, from Egypt all the way round to the Danubian frontier with his own men. And once he's got control of the east, he can then march back to Rome. But, you know, he wants to consolidate his position in the east first, and he stays at Antioch.
Well, Herodian says he loiters in Antioch. cultivating his beard.
Yes, yes. So this is part of the tradition where emperors are enervated by Antioch. They go decadent, you know, they frolic with courtesans and pantomime actors, much like Lucius Verus, for example. Pescennius Niger, you might remember, gets the same treatment. And yes, he's supposed to be covered in jewels and indulges in the shows. And the army supposedly grows resentful of him for this reason.
Mm.
I think it's more likely they grow resentful towards him because of what he does to their pay. Loyal listeners may remember that Caracalla had increased army pay by 50%.
Yes.
Which was a major pay rise, which you don't want to then see walked back. Now, Macrinus said this pay rise cost the treasury 70 million denarii.
And he'd just given the Parthians a big
payout. 200 million sesterces, yes, exactly.
So suddenly he's worried about finance.
Yes, exactly. And Dio has some slightly contradictory information. So first he says Macrinus reduced the pay of the Praetorian Guard to that of Septimius Severus. But then later on, Dio says that Macrinus only cut the pay of new recruits into the army. So the idea is that new recruits would receive the level under Septimius Severus, but the current soldiers would receive the increased pay.
Mm.
And of course, we can see how this would lead to divisions within the army itself, because if you're going to pay people different rates for doing the same job, they're not going to be very happy about that.
They're going to fondly remember Caracalla.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And Dio says the impact was all the more because all the expeditionary forces were gathered together in one place. He says it would have been different if they had all returned to their base camps in their different legions along the Danube, the Rhine, but they're all here together. So they are a powerful unit, which if Macrinus loses their support, he's going to lose the empire. Now, you may be wondering what's been happening to the other members of Septimius Severus's family.
Well, usually you just never hear from them again, but in this case, they're going to cause trouble.
Yes. Yeah, so we talked in the last Caracalla episode about what happened to poor Julia Domna, how she had originally stayed in the East and that Macrinus had treated her with great honour. But then she starts to try and plot against him, but she deteriorates into grief at Caracalla's death. She's seen Geta killed as well in her arms, and she also has breast cancer as well.
Mm.
So she actually starves herself to death.
Okay.
But there are other members of the family. So Julia Domna's sister, Julia Maesa, who has two daughters, and they each have a son. And Macrinus sends them back to their home of Emesa in Syria.
They'd been in Rome at the time.
It's difficult to tell. Herodian implies that Maesa had been in Rome and was sent back to Emesa. But we know from an inscription that some of them were also accompanying Caracalla when he was in Asia Minor. So whether they'd accompanied him through Asia Minor, then gone back to Rome, we don't know. But I'll talk more in the Elagabalus episode about that.
Yeah.
But wherever they were from, they're sent back to their hometown. But what this means is that there are male relatives of the Severan family still alive, and they're going to try and exploit the discontent of the army with Macrinus.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, as always, very appreciated. You can follow the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the East, and Elagabalus is the sun. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. Parting is such sweet sorrow, and thanks for listening.